Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Gas is probably even more closely tied to the oil price than what diesel price is.
Greg Ibendahl is a Kansas State University farm economist looking at seasonal tendencies and storage.
For the gas price, certainly a strong correlation there. The gasoline prices are certainly lower than they were too. Gas is a little unusual, though, compared to the other fuel like diesel fuel, because gas follows a definite seasonality. You always see higher prices, almost without exception, almost always from Memorial Day to Labor Day. So that's tended to, we see the peak in the gas prices, and then it tends to decline during the wintertime. Diesel has a little bit of seasonality, but it tends to be more in the spring and fall. Really, if farmers are buying fuel on an ad-needed basis, they're probably buying at the peak of seasonality for diesel, although the diesel seasonality is not near as strong as what the gasoline one is.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Since the minute I got to Congress about 6 years ago, Colin Peterson was a mentor of mine, is a mentor of mine. And I told him if I ever got to Congress, I wanted to be on this committee.
Ranking member of the House Ag Committee represents the 2nd District of Minnesota, Angie Craig.
My grandfather was a farm foreman. He farmed rice, he farmed cotton, some beans down in Arkansas growing up. And his farmer lost the farm in the 80s farm crisis, and my grandfather lost his job. So I have a deep admiration for people who feed, fuel, and clothe this country, and I wanted to be here to fight for them.
And what about the farm bill?
The farm bill did not get across the finish line in the last session of Congress. In fact, Republicans didn't even bring it to the House floor after it came out of the committee. And today, where we are is it's not where we were even a couple of years ago, because input costs have gone even higher and commodities prices for most folks has gone down. So, you know, I know we need a farm bill. We need a 5-year full farm bill. And unfortunately, right now, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are intending to do what I'm going to call a piecemeal deal as part of the budget bill that's coming up here in Washington over the course of the next couple of weeks. So they want to plus up reference prices and crop insurance, which, you know, I agree needs to happen, but it needs to happen as one of 12 titles in the farm bill. If it doesn't happen through a traditional 5-year farm bill coalition, then commodities are going to be pitted against one another, and we just don't want that.
Some of those lesser known sections, though, are vital.
Well, I do think rural development is a really important part of the farm bill, and one that gets overlooked, because, you know, it's not just the family farm, it's the community that farm economy supports, and whether that's rural hospitals, which can be so important and one of the leading employers in a community, or whether that's, you know, just being able to get access to farm credit. It's a big country that we have the privilege of living in, and we have a diverse set of stakeholders. And we also have, hungry folks in our country, veterans, seniors, children. And remember, the Farm Bill also includes the nutrition title. And that nutrition title isn't, you know, just feeding hungry people. It certainly is that, too. But that's $30 billion in farm income. That's spending that goes into truckers being able to drive food to the store, the retailers that sell it. And I think we forget sometimes that the nutrition title is really important to the farm economy as well.
She is a member of the Congressional Problem Solvers Caucus.
Well, we're not solving many problems right now, unfortunately, but it's a group of Democrats and Republicans. We have to have equal numbers in the caucus, and we look for opportunities to work together. Of course, the two parties are going to, you know, have a lot of differences, a lot of policies we can agree on. But boy, I find a lot of common ground when it comes to, you know, for example, extending E15 year round across the country so that people could build the infrastructure in place. I find a lot of common ground on raising the, you know, available credit for new and beginning farmers. I find a lot of common ground on ag labor issues. And so we look for what we can work together on, and we, forgive each other for the things that we don't agree on. And at the end of the day, if there were more problem solvers or people actually trying to solve problems in the Congress, the country would probably work a bit better.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Farm receipts in 2024 decreased by $1.8 billion.
Alejandro Plastina is director of the Rural and Farm Finance Policy Center at the University of Missouri.
Total expenses decreased by $9 billion. So comparing those two, there was an increase of about $7 billion, $7.2 billion in net farm income, and government payments contributed an additional there was a decrease in government payments of $2.9 billion. So the total decrease in net farm income was $8.2 billion in 2024. Now, going into 2025, farm receipts are projected to go down by $0.8 billion. Total expenses would go down by $0.7 billion. So there's a $0.1 billion decrease there. But government payments are actually increasing net farm income by $33 billion. So that's what these government payments really mean for agriculture. That's a tremendous influx of revenue, of liquidity, and the net farm income would go up by $40.6 billion, again, mostly driven by government payments. If those programs, those ad hoc programs, dry up in 2026, then as expected, the net farm income will go down to the long-term declining trajectory, and that's what's concerning. So we have to keep an eye on what's happening around agriculture, what's happening around agricultural prices and policies that affect this net farm income outlook. For example, the uncertainty from trade effects that are likely to affect agricultural exports. Right now, on the left, you can see the major importers of U.S. agricultural exports, so where U.S. products are going. Those countries highlighted in the graph are those that are currently evaluating changes in their tariff structure based on tariff discussions with the U.S. Now, the question is whether the trade effects will resemble to some extent what happened in 2018, 2019, 2020, and whether there will be a market facilitation program or another kind of program to supplement the loss in revenue, in export revenue that was provided during 2019, 2020. And if that will happen in 2026 or later. So the timing and the magnitude of the any new program will be critical for agriculture. And also, there's uncertainty on the input side of things because, as you know, most of the potash, for example, is imported, most of the imported potash is coming from Canada. So right now, there's a pause in these high tariffs, but we can go, and potash and energy have a 10% tariff with Canada, but we don't know what will happen, whether higher tariffs will be implemented or not. And we have to be careful about how tariffs will impact not only the destination of our exports, but also the cost of our imported inputs, I should say.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We have the meat demand monitor. We'll talk about in a minute, but it's survey based and it's more current, like the most recent month we can talk about.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is Kansas State livestock economist, talks about declining meat demand.
And then USDA based data, so, you know, ERS retail price and those kinds of things, is more lagged. There's about a 6 week lag to that. And I'm interjecting that both for some clarity, but also to say why we're going to talk about February numbers. Because the USDA data that's most available, most recently, is for February. And using that February information, domestic meat demand declined compared to February of 24. Beef demand down 2.5%, pork over 8%, chicken over 4.5%. Beef stayed ahead of February of 2023. So if you look back 2 years instead of one, but pork and chicken was down compared to even 2 years ago. I'm interjecting this because, you know, I've spent a lot of time writing and talking about macroeconomic concerns in recent weeks. This past week was a nice relief from that. But in general, those concerns are still there. And I think it's really important we monitor domestic meat demand. As consumers in the U.S. are getting quite pessimistic and concerned, it's possible. I mean, I hope it doesn't occur, but it's possible they're tightening the wallet. And it's sort of a self-generated demand decline for the meat industry. I want to be clear, that's not because of any concerns on safety or quality and so forth. We have a multi-year good run for meat demand that says the public wants meat protein. But if they're concerned about their finances as part of a much broader macroeconomic situation, it wouldn't surprise me if they reduce their interest and they pull back their bidding power, so to speak. Maybe their cost of living outpaces their wages also is a possibility here as 25 develops. And February is consistent with that. So I hope when we get the March numbers and April numbers and so forth, that things are better than that. But February definitely sent that signal to me.
And it's tied back to consumer financial sentiment.
A special report we put out for the first quarter of 2025 was focused in on this financial sentiment aspect, how people think about their finances. Are they better, the same, or worse than the year, year before? And how does that relate to meat demand and meat consumption rates? And sidebar, the consumption and demand are not the same number. Consumption is just frequency and how much you had. Demand accounts for what you're willing to pay. So there's no price component just in prior day meals. But anyways, we document that at length. I'm doing a call out there because I think it's very important to monitor that. Everybody's picking up on my tone here. The widely cited University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index had a very concerning read in the middle of April. Consumer and expectations on inflation have spiked. Their expectations for unemployment have spiked. Their overall pessimism has spiked. And I'm not trying to be painful here. I'm just being clear. We see the same thing in the sentiment measures that we keep in the MDM that are built following that University of Michigan exercise. And most importantly, we find meat consumption and demand grows if you're optimistic on your finances, which is not surprising, but it also declines pretty starkly if you're concerned. So if, in fact, as 2025 continues, the U.S. public is pessimistic per these indices I'm talking about, I would anticipate that being consistent with a reduction in domestic and, by the way, foreign demand as well. I mean, that's not what we track in the MDM. That's why I'm concerned about it and talk about it a lot. And Justin and I break that down for the first quarter. So call out to that if you want to read more about that, because you see a lot about that in the general news. The meat demand monitor is supported by the beef and pork checkoff based here at K-State. Everything we put out is fully available. So go to agmanager.info and or email or Google me, and I'll get that and other related resources to you.
Last year, the most consumed type of meat in the U.S., broiler chicken, 102.1 pounds per capita. Figure is expected to increase to 110.4 pounds by 2034. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I like these images.
Matt Makins is a meteorologist with Cattle Facts, speaking at the recent Hemp Hill, Texas County Beef Conference.
But this image is that health I showed you at the very beginning. It's just the health plants and everything. Everything looks good around Texas. But then we look at, and this is not a drought thing, okay? It's just the health of the plant. Because you look at Tennessee, Kentucky, Boot Heel in Missouri, they've had a lot of water, but it's been way too much. Way too much. The plants there are not handling it well. Okay, we can take an image like that. And then we can also look at the same image and be like, how has that plant leaf changed in the last week? Is it telling us already visually it's headed to drought? That's what these images do. So in terms of drought, look at north central Nebraska, South Dakota, Wyoming. The plants are not healthy now, and they're headed in a more unhealthy direction. That's drought. Look at Texas, a lot of drought there. The plants are already saying, I know it may not be officially on your government drought monitor, but I'm telling you right now, I'm not very happy. That's what these plants are saying. How do you see this, that kind of image played out in your inboxes? Every week, USDA sends out the crop progress reports, right? Do you subscribe to those? Do you get any of those? They'll just say, is the crop healthy, fair, poor, any of that stuff. In terms of ranges and pastures, this is also on the website that goes to you. This updated last night. These images did not, but the ones on the website did. So here we are. We're for Texas rangeland. What's the crop condition for our pastures? Right there, that solid black line. Okay, this is where all of this presentation starts to make sense, okay? This is looking at your pasture, your grass health, every year since the mid-90s. Where are we this year? We're ahead of your five-year average. We're ahead of your 20-year average right now, thanks to the moisture that's fallen here. So in terms of day-to-day operation, your pasture Texas as a whole is much healthier than it has been in years. We can limit that and see that black line going up. That's thanks to all the recent rainfall. So now we've climbed above the five-year average. What about New Mexico? It's hanging tight with the last 5 years. So when you look at all this weather garbly goop that I gave you, the models and the history, what does that mean? For New Mexico, we're in the same boat that we've been the last 5 years. Let's go to just kind of glump the southern plains together. So for this, I did New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma. The black line, you can't see it because of the legend and the pixelation of the screen. But on the top left, it has 2011, 2012, 2013, 2021, 22, 23, 24, 25. Okay? So our biggest drought years for the southern plains, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, we're already doing better than we had out of those drought years. And the outlook, I just drew a red line on it. We're going to have moisture through May for parts of Texas. Then we get a surge from the monsoon that hits New Mexico and Arizona to give New Mexico a boost. Oklahoma's in good shape right now. At the end of this season, the pastures, the rangeland, forages, that health is much better than we were sitting in previous 5 years and not as bad as what we were in 11, 12, or 13. The sad part from a beef industry, since this is a beef conference, let's go to the north. Nebraska, Dakotas, Wyoming. Wyoming is a major problem. Eastern Wyoming, there's nothing. Just there, the grass is terrible. If you compare the northern plains, which includes Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, same idea. The big drought years of the last 10 years, where are they going to go? Troy said I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong in this case. Because if the projection is accurate, this will be the worst year on this record since the mid-90s for pasture and rangeland for any producer in the northern plains. They don't have grass now. They're not getting the water. So their outlook is worse than 11, 12, 13, worse than 21, 22, 23. So when it comes to a herd rebuild, as Troy said cautiously, that's why it's cautious.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Other major crop, soybeans.
Alejandro Plastina is director of the Rural and Farm Finance Policy Center at the University of Missouri, looking at projections for soybeans.
In this case, by the time these projections were made, the price ratio between corn and soybeans favored corn. So that increase in corn area is impacting the soybean area negatively, of course. So we have fewer planted acres in this projection for 2025, higher yields, and with that, a higher production. So higher yields are expected to offset the decline in planted area. So even with lower acreage, we have a larger crop, and unfortunately, the demand side is not expanding as fast as the production side, and the ending stocks are expected to go up, and with that, bring prices down to close to $10 per bushel.
In addition to looking at the projections for soybeans, Plastina also looked at wheat, corn, and livestock.
In general, those cash receipts are, as an aggregate, going up. In this graph, all lines, poultry, eggs, dairy products, hogs, and cattle, they are all going up. So that's good news for livestock, the livestock sector. Now, for how long can we expect those prices to go up? Well, livestock, particularly cattle prices, tend to move with the herd expansion and contraction. And this long-term graph shows that the contraction of the cow herd might last until 2026. And with that, we could expect prices to remain supported by this short supply until 2026 or 2027. But after that, a recomposition of the cow herd might soften prices. And that's what we see in this graph. The fed steer prices received by farmers selling fed steers, that's the yellow line at the bottom, or the gold line at the bottom, would continue to go up until 2027. After that, they would decline. But, you know, that's good news for cattle producers. But on the other side of the graph, where we have the black line, and that's going up even faster. And that's the price of feeder steers. So that's the input of production of livestock, right, of fed steers. So costs for cattle producers are going up faster than received prices. So the good news is that feed costs are going down. So depending on the equation on purchased livestock expenses versus feed expenses, margins could continue to be healthy for 1, 2, or 3 years. But clearly, margins are getting thinner and thinner over time, but still remaining healthy for a couple of years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Wheat use, there's our food use. That's a billion bushels. It doesn't change. We fed a lot of wheat in the drought of 2012 when corn supplies were tight, but otherwise we don't feed that much wheat in the U.S. The variable use category for wheat, it's corn. It's a bigger number relative or for wheat, but the same kind of variability of export potential is extremely important for our wheat market. We're seeing the prospects for, a development in wheat and price reaction to that, much like we saw a year ago.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain marketing economist, Dr. Mark Welch.
This is southern Russia between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And some of you with foreign languages much better than mine might help me pronounce that. Zimovniki, right in the heart of southern Russia's winter wheat producing area, which is the primary wheat producing area in Russia today. What does their weather map look like? Looks like that one. Accumulated precipitation, almost exactly the same as such as in Kansas, about 75 millimeters. They're not as dry relative to we are here in Kansas, but we have been below normal since the 1st of January and now seeing a little greater degree of separation as the crop's breaking dormancy, starting to wake up, starting to that vegetative reproductive stages. What I think is interesting to note is the temperature deviation for the month of March. It's been significantly warmer. So that crop is going to break dormancy more quickly, start developing into that vegetative and reproductive stage more quickly than what happened a year ago about in the middle of April. Had a freeze that hit that part of the world. It dropped below freezing for several days in a row in mid-April. And so this crop is grown in a part of the world that could still be very vulnerable to some deviations in those weather patterns as we move through this year. I can't predict that's going to happen, but we are setting ourselves up for an area that's drier than normal and likely breaking dormancy much earlier than normal, which creates, again, some volatility perhaps around production numbers coming out of the number one exporter of wheat in the world.
Explains why a pullback in consumer spending is so pronounced in the economy.
And we could see higher food prices, even though the grain prices may come down. They may not lower food prices in these particular, depending on your economy and where you're at. But if you look at, I think, the broader impact of those would be of just the economic activity driven by consumer fears and consumer sentiment, that if we're more concerned about what the future looks like in 3 months or 6 months or a year, if I'm pulling back in those areas that I can. So maybe I'm consuming food products that are maybe more cost efficient. Maybe I'm not eating out as much. So some of those food prepared foods, or food away from home. And then certainly that would go into areas of more durable goods, those factors that if we can put those off for a period of time. So maybe I want to buy them now ahead of maybe some disruptions. Or what I'm sensing, and do you sense a general mood of just of a hunker down mentality, of a sense of let's just wait and see how this thing is all kind of either going to blow over or how I can respond to whatever that horizon or new environment looks like moving forward. But that sense of just I'm going to back up, I'm going to pull back, and then we'll kind of reassess how things look coming out of as we get maybe some more clarity around some of these issues. And that attitude and that sentiment is not positive for economic growth. Not positive for economic growth or consumption of most of our commodities. Now, there'll be some commodities consumption will go up in those times, but for the broad spectrum of commodities and general economic activity, you'll see consumer spending contract in that kind of world. And of course, consumer spending in the U.S. economy, that's 70% of our economy. And so you don't have to pull that one back very much to have some significant impacts way beyond agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When it comes to possible U.S. wildfire activity for May and the June through August summer period,
we're probably going to be a little bit more active than we normally are across the country.
National Interagency Fire Center meteorologist Jim Wallman says the May and early June forecast focuses on the southern Atlantic coast, particularly Florida, where dry weather has occurred for months.
Channels that they have water are running very low, the water table is very low, and that enables the swamps to burn more readily than they normally do.
Including a current fire complex in the Everglades, expected to burn until rainy season starts in late June. Traditional shifts of fire activity later in the summer are expected in the southern plains and western U.S., with concerns about raised activity in parts of the Pacific Northwest undergoing a warm and dry spring that could expose fire fuels earlier than normal. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.